This is Poetry Off the Shelf from the Poetry Foundation, August 20th, 2013. I'm Curtis Fox. This week, Charles Darwin Condensed. During most of her life, Loreen Nideker was overlooked as a poet. She was poor, working various low-paying jobs and living without indoor plumbing in her native state of Wisconsin. But before she died in 1970, Nideker started to get some critical recognition. And since her death, her reputation has continued to snowball so that these days she's quite a big deal in the world of American poetry. Hannah Brooks Modell is a poet and critic, also from Wisconsin, and she recently wrote about Nideker in a piece up on our website, poetryfoundation.org. She joins me now from New England Public Radio in Amherst, Massachusetts. Hannah, Loreen Nideker is thought of as an objectivist poet. She herself called her poetry a condensery, which sounds a lot more fun than objectivism. How would you describe her poetry to someone who has never read it?
To someone who'd never read her before, I would say that she's very clear and very mysterious.
Clear and mysterious, the two qualities you wouldn't necessarily associate them, but I think that's a very apt way to put it. You note in your piece that Nideker herself was suspicious of what a biography could tell us about a poet's poems. But what can you give us a little capsule biography of her life?
Sure. So she was born in Fort Atkinson, Wisconsin, and she went to Beloit College for 2 years and then had to return home for reasons nobody's quite sure of. Her parents had a difficult marriage, and her mother eventually became deaf, and she spent quite a bit of her life caring for her mother. Mm-hmm. But she read the objectivist issue of poetry when it came out and sort of struck up a correspondence with Louis Zukofsky. She'd been writing poems before this, but Zukofsky kind of really gave her another mind to think with, and they had a lifelong correspondence. And she went out to New York on a few occasions in the 1930s, became his lover, and she moved back to Wisconsin.
Pretty much for the rest of her life. That trip to New York was one of the few times she ventured out of Wisconsin, right?
Yeah, she did live in Wisconsin for the rest of her life on Black Hawk Island.
And got to know a lot of poets by correspondence and developed a literary life, but while living what's been described as a hard scrabble life, right?
Yeah, a very kind of subsistence existence. She, was a cleaning lady. She was a proofreader. She had sort of menial jobs. But in her letters, she is pretty clear that, in some ways she's choosing this life because it gives her time to write and time to read. And those are the most important things to her.
Mm-hmm. Now we're going to listen to one poem from the only recording she ever made. And can you tell us a little bit about this recording and why she was such a reluctant reader?
Yeah. As you'll hear in the recording, she's not a great reader of her own work.
Yeah.
And after this recording, she wrote to a friend that she could feel how you would compose differently for a listening audience. So she really writes for the page, even though she's lauded as this poet who can do amazing sonic things.
Now, she's known for her relatively short, condensed poems, but we're going to listen to one that's relatively long for her. It's called Darwin, and we're going to stop and chat between sections. Why'd she write a poem about Charles Darwin?
Well, she was fascinated with naturalists her whole life, and her poetry is filled with sort of thumbnail biographies about Carl Linnaeus or Audubon. So she really feels kinship with these figures.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything that we need to know about part one before we hear it, apart from the fact that there are quotes from Darwin in this section?
I guess maybe thinking about this as preface or foreword. Later on, she goes into very specific details from Darwin's exploits on the beagle. So this is sort of, I think, Nideker's overview, maybe.
Okay. Here we go. Here's part one of Loreen Nideker's Darwin.
Darwin. His holy, slowly mulled over matter. Not all delirium of delight, as were the forests of Brazil. Species are not, it is like confessing a murder, immutable. He was often becalmed in this port desire by illness or rested from species at billiard table. As to man, I believe man in the same predicament with other animals.
So she begins that poem very oddly by referring to Darwin as his holy, not his holiness, which would also be odd, but his holy.
His holy, slowly mulled over matter.
What do you make of that?
Well, I think she really revered, if not Darwin, his ideas about evolution and found that they connected with things, you know, by the end of her life that she really firmly believed. And it's interesting how these lines trickle down the page as well, so that holy kind of morphs into slowly, and you can trace the L's from holy to slowly to mold.
Yeah, it sounds wonderful. His holy, slowly mold over matter.
Yeah.
And then there's a quote, which listeners may or may not have heard.
Species are not. It is like confessing a murder, immutable.
Species are not. It is like confessing a murder, immutable.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm guessing that's from Darwin. I'm taking that as to be from something from his notebooks or something like that.
It's actually, yeah, from a letter he wrote to his good friend Joseph Hooker. He wrote this letter after he gets back from the Beagle. He's sort of testing out his theory of evolution in letters to friends. He doesn't publish on the origin of the species until almost, you know, 20-some years after he's back. So he's really conscious that this is a big deal, and he's sort of scared about it. So he sends out letters to you know, he was friends with all the great scientists of the day, testing out what people's reactions will be. He's sort of guilt-ridden about what he's thinking and what he's proposing.
He was often becalmed in this port desire by illness or rested from species at billiard table.
I love that very odd formulation. He rested from species at billiard, basically saying the guy liked to play billiards for a little R&R.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
And then another quote from Darwin.
As to man, I believe man in the same predicament with other animals.
That's a radical statement for the time.
Right.
In other words, we are not special in God's eyes.
Yeah.
And then in section two, it's about Darwin's travels in the mountains of South America. Let's listen to that.
Cordilleras to climb.
Let me just interrupt it right there because she mispronounced it. It's cordilleras to climb, and cordilleras are mountain ranges in Spanish.
Cordilleras to climb. Andean peaks tossed about like the crust of a broken pie. Icy wind, higher, harder. Chileans advised eat onions for shortness of breath. Heavy on him. Andes miners carried up great loads, not allowed to stop for breath. Fossil bones near Santa Fe, spider bites galled, fever tended by an old woman. Dear Susan, I'm ravenous for the sound of the pianoforte.
This section especially is full of kind of images of consuming and being consumed. So you have the onions and the broken pie, the spider bite, I'm ravenous.
Mm-hmm. The next section brings in Robert Fitzroy, the famous captain of the HMS Beagle, who often quarreled with Darwin during his voyage. And he was also quite religious. They visit the Galapagos Islands, and Darwin's theory of evolution is starting to come together.
Fitzroy blinked. Seashells on mountaintops. The laws of change rode the seas. Without the good captain, who could not concede, land could rise from the sea. Until, before his eyes, earthquake. Talcahuana Bay drained out. All water wall up from the ocean. 6 seconds, demolish the town. The will of God, let us pray. And now the Galapagos Islands, hideous black lava, the shore so hot it burned their feet through their boots. Reptile life, Melville here later said the chief sound was a hiss. 1,000 turtle monsters drive together to the water. Blood-bright crabs hunt ticks on lizards' backs. Flightless cormorants, cold sea creatures, penguins, seals here in tropical waters. Hell for Fitzroy, but for Darwin, paradise puzzle with the jigsaw gists beginning to fit.
That's just a wonderful last line.
Yeah.
But for Darwin, paradise puzzle with the jigsaw gists beginning to fit. That's a wonderful way of showing that Darwin is putting his pieces together for his great theory. Part of the importance of this section, I think, is that she brings up the religious conflict that Darwin started, basically, mm-hmm. by suggesting that the will of God and the will of nature were not the same.
Right.
Earthquake. Talcahuana Bay drained out. All water wall up from the ocean. 6 seconds, demolish the town. The will of God, let us pray.
So in the next section, Darwin is back home, and he's not yet published his famous books. It took him many years to publicly make the case about the role of evolution and man's place in the natural order. Let's hear section 4.
Years, balancing probabilities. I am ill, he said, and books are slow work. Studied pigeons, barnacles, earthworms, extracted seeds from bird dung, brought home Drosera, saw insects tracked by its tentacles, the fact that a plant should secrete an acid acutely akin to the digestive fluid of an animal. Years till he published. He wrote Lyell, don't forget to send me the carcass of your half-bred African cat should it die.
So there's lots of details here. Mm-hmm. I mean, Darwin's glory years are over, but he's trying to put it all together and doing a little research. And he brought home Drosera, she says. What is that?
Drosera, he actually didn't bring it home from the beagle. This is many years later. He has all these sort of like side projects. And I think it's really interesting that Nitaker can choose what she highlights about Darwin, and she chooses to focus on his sort of weird obsessions. He gets really into pigeons. He spends years and years studying barnacles. And then he looks at earthworms later on in life. And Drosera are kind of like Venus flytrap-like plants. Actually, Nitaker is really interested in them as well. And so in some ways, this section to me is like Nitaker asserting a certain kind of affinity. And when she has Darwin say, I am ill, he said, and books are slow work. I mean, Nitaker was, you know, sort of famously, her books took a long time, especially her collected poems, TNG, was almost not published during her lifetime. So I feel like in this section, she's projecting. Yeah, she's really interested in Drosera. She's really interested in how it's a plant that has animal-like characteristics. And, you know, again, this is sort of speaking to, I think, her sense that and Darwin's sense that we're part of a great chain of being and things are always influencing other things. And, you know, we're not that different from muskrats or, you know, the birds that Nitaker would see on her walks around Black Hawk Island.
So the next and final section is kind of a summing up with Darwin looking back on his trip and the consequences of his thinking.
I remember, he said, those tropical nights at sea. We sat and talked on the booms. Tierra del Fuego's shining glaciers, translucent blue, clear down almost to the indigo sea. By the way, Carlyle thought it most ridiculous anyone should care whether a glacier moved a little quicker or a little slower or moved at all. Darwin sailed out of Good Success Bay to carcass conclusions. The universe, not built by brute force, but designed by laws, the details left to the working of chance. Let each man hope and believe what he can.
And that is the end of this poem. Where did that last quote come from? Do you know? Let each man hope and believe what he can.
Yeah, those last two stanzas come from a letter that Darwin wrote to his good friend, the American botanist Asa Gray, who actually Nitaker also wrote a poem about. Asa Gray believes in evolution, but also I think believes that God is kind of the prime mover, or that, you know, there are ways in which a theistic worldview can fit with an evolutionary worldview. And Darwin and he exchanged quite a few letters. And, you know, that last quote, let each man hope and believe what he can, is sort of reticent in a way. You know, he's not an ideologue. He's not trying to force evolution down anyone's throat. And I feel like Nitaker would again feel a certain affinity with that reticence.
There's a very confusing line in there. Darwin sailed out of Good Success Bay to carcass conclusions.
Yeah, that is a really weird. And I think that partly she's playing with success and carcass. Of course, they're like stacked right on top of one another in the poem. And carcass again picks up the carcass of the half-bred African cat. And Darwin was really sick for a lot of his life. He had all these stomach troubles. Nobody knew exactly what was wrong with him. And so he was kind of a recluse, and like Nitaker, carried on, you know, kind of a huge correspondence, much, much larger than Nitaker's, of course. But he would refer to himself in letters as a carcass.
Hmm.
And so I think all of that is kind of in the word, but I think it's also, in a real way, his science is based on carcasses, right? It's like based on the study of specimens right. and dead things. But it's also his theory, in the end, sort of pointed to the death of one kind of worldview or one kind of way of believing in the world. So I think, again, there are lots of meanings bound up in that.
Hannah Brooks Modell's piece on Loreen Nidecker is on poetryfoundation.org. The Darwin poem and the audio of Nidecker reading it are up on the site as well, so you can listen and read it and other Nidecker poems at the same time. If you have any comments on this program, email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org. The theme music for this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. For Poetry Off the Shelf, I'm Curtis Fox. Thanks for listening.